is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, October 3rd, 2019. I'm Buster Olney, and producing back in Bristol is Troy Farkas. And Troy, I got a question for you this morning, which is pertinent based on what happened after the American League wildcard game last night. Can you get drunk absorbing alcohol through your skin? Because if that's possible, then I might be in trouble based on what happened in the Tampa Bay clubhouse after last night's game.
You know, Buster,
what do you think?
As I've said on this podcast, I'm kind of a health freak, so I'm always looking for ways to get drunk without really drinking the calories. And in my research that I've done in the past, it does not work like that. At least I don't think so, Buster. So.
Oh my God. It was like they, you know, they open up the champagne bottles and I was in there and, you know, doing the post game interviews and you knew that you're going to get sprayed a little bit, but I'm not even sure who the player was because he had these goggles on and you can't see him as much. The players are all protected, but you know, the media members are like gazelles, right? And, like the players are like the lions. And this player looked at me and said, are you running from me? Are you running from me? And then he started to absolutely douse me. And then after that, I couldn't see anything. It felt like because my eyes were burning from all the champagne. And then Jesus Aguilar just kept coming after me. It went on for like 10 minutes. I'd be in the middle of an interview like with Kevin Kiermaier, and I just felt him just pouring champagne over my head. I couldn't see anything. And I'm asking, talking to Kiermaier with basically with my eyes closed. It was pathetic.
Well, I'm looking forward to Monday when we talk to Todd Radom about locker room celebrations because I have some thoughts on all this.
Okay. And when I was done, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I get to go back to the hotel and take my clothes off and stick them in a bag. And they were like, no, you got to go on SportsCenter. Yep. And I walked over toward the set and Mark Teixeira was there and Tim Kirchner were there and Carl Ravitch. They were like, oh my God, you smell bad. I was so soaked. It was amazing how soaked it was. All right. Now, they open the gates at the Coliseum at 11 a.m. local time and getting the crowd ready. The Athletics versus the Tampa Bay Rays. You get Sean Manaea. You got Charlie Morton. A lot of momentum, it seemed like. Potentially a home field advantage for the Athletics, but man, that changed in a hurry.
Manaea winds and works, and the 3-1 is a swing and a fly ball sent to right field. Pretty well hit. Laureano back. He turns, and he will watch it go. Yandy Diaz with an opposite field home run. And just like there was thunder early in the game last night in D.C., the visitors strike quickly here tonight in Oakland. Tampa Bay leads 1-0.
Yandy Diaz, somewhat of a surprise that he was in the starting lineup at first base and leading off because he played in only one game since July 22nd because of injuries. But, man, it paid off in a hurry. In the top of the second inning, the Rays offense continued.
And a 2-1 on the way. And a swing and a ball hit pretty well to center field. Hit really well to center field and gone. Crushed to straightaway center. Well up into the batter's eye above the Holy Toledo sign. A two-run blast for Garcia. And the Rays up the lead to 3-0.
Sean Manaea struggling to pitch in the inner half of the plate against right-handed batters. You could see the Rays leaning out over the plate, looking to drive the ball through the middle of the opposite field. Yandy Diaz came to the plate again in the top of the third.
2-2 on the way and a fastball, and he sends another one to the opposite field in deep, and he's done it again! Yandy Diaz with his second home run! And the lead grows to 4-0 for Tampa Bay.
Those calls from my man, Dan Shulman, on ESPN Radio, and of course working with Chris Singleton. It was 4-1 in the top of the fifth inning. Tommy Pham at the plate.
The right-hander sets, fires, and a fastball swung on and lifted to deep center field. Canna back, Canna at the wall, and it is gone. Tommy Pham with a home run. The fourth home run of the night for Tampa Bay, and they go on top 5-1.
That's right, 5-1. Charlie Morton went five innings for Tampa Bay, and after that, Kevin Cash turned to his parade of relievers who were outstanding. This is what it sounded like in the bottom of the ninth inning.
And the 1-2 on the way, and a fastball swung on and missed, and that'll do it. The Tampa Bay Rays get a great pitching performance from four different pitchers, play stellar defense tonight, hit four home runs, And the celebration is on the infield right now for the Rays as they come into the Coliseum here in Oakland, and they subdue the A's by a score of 5-1, and they have won the wild card game and are on their way to a division series to take on the Houston Astros.
And right after the game on the field, I got a chance to talk with Tommy Pham.
Tommy, how about the big guy here with what he did tonight?
Impressive. You know, kudos to him. He kept himself game ready for as long as he's been down on the DL. We really need him, man. I've been saying it all year. He's such a good bat. Doesn't strike out much. He knows the strike zone, and he hits the ball hard. We need him.
All right, when you hit your home run, your face just lit up. How gratifying is that for you to have that moment after the journey in your career?
Oh, man. I'm just a kid from Vegas that always dreamed about big moments like this. So, you know, to come through to help the team win, I mean, you can't ask for more.
All right, you guys get through this game. Next on to the Houston Astros, how dangerous are the Tampa Bay Rays?
I think, you know, everyone in the world is starting to see it right now. You know, but we have a tough road ahead of us. Houston's a great team, but we played them well this year. But it's going to be a dogfight.
Kevin Cash, the Rays manager, talked about Diaz's performance.
He did. I don't know if we expected that type of performance, but I said to Buster, I think, in the third inning, he's made us look a lot smarter than what we really are by getting him back in the lineup, and knew that, you know, he was a presence, especially against left-handed pitching. Got us off to a really good start with the home run. This crowd, this stadium was, I mean, impressive to be able to get a lead and somewhat calm it. I don't know if that totally calmed it, but Yandy was a big part of that.
He talked about his young, talented roster.
We're fortunate. We have really smart people that can evaluate talent. And I agree with you. We've kind of prided ourselves, this organization, for many years on maybe finding the players that have fallen through the cracks a little bit. And we've got a handful of them on the roster right now that are main pieces to what we're trying to accomplish. A ton of credit goes to the front office for recognizing that. It's easy to turn away on a guy, a young player that doesn't come out of the gate on fire, but does some special things under the surface. And I think we've got a bunch of those guys that do that.
For the second straight years, the Oakland Athletics lost the wild card game. Bob Melvin, the Oakland manager, talked about the importance of winning the American League West.
Yeah, we've won a lot of games the last couple years. What we need to do probably is win the division if we want to play a longer series. You know, we're in a tough division as it is, but proud of what they did this year. I mean, we just got beat in one game, and you know, everybody's in there is pretty upset about it.
He talked about the Tampa Bay Rays.
Look, the Rays match up as well as anybody in baseball, and they use their entire 25-man roster. They have terrific starting pitching. They have great bullpen. They match up well, so they're going to give any team a problem.
Incredibly, for the Oakland Athletics, that's 9 straight losses in winner-take-all games, a streak dating back many, many years. Matt Chapman was asked about that after the game.
Just disappointed. Felt really confident going into the game. Had Manaea going out there. We've been in this situation before. We were at home. And, you know, we went out there expecting to win just like they did. And it just hurts when you come up short.
Sean Manaea, who was on the mound when Tampa Bay took the lead, talked about the blame.
I don't even know how to describe it. It's a tough loss, and it's lost solely on me. I had one job, and I did poorly, really poorly, and, you know, let everyone down. So it's, you know, it sucks, you know. But, you know, hopefully I can learn from these kinds of things. And
as Manaea talked, you could tell he was absolutely devastated.
Honestly, it all means nothing. You know, everybody worked so hard to get here, and you know, everyone trusted me to go out there and do my job right, and you know, I failed at that. So, all that work, I think, means nothing.
Mark Teixeira and Tim Kirkjian were on SportsCenter last night talking about the Tampa Bay Rays and how they took the crowd out of it.
Well, this was a game that the A's had to get the lead early because we knew how dominant Tampa Bay's pitching could be. And we expected with the crowd and we expected with, you know, Manaea being so good 4-0 in five September starts, we thought the A's could get that lead, but it never happened.
And here's how dominant that pitching was. The A's went 1-for-16 with runners on base, 0-for-4 with men in scoring position, 12 strikeouts in the game, and the only run they scored was on a three-base error and a sacrifice fly. That's dominant right. Tampa pitching.
Last night, Chris Singleton was on with Freddie and Fitzsimmons talking about the Rays.
There was a lot of confidence that this was the year. All right, A's are going to move into a division series, potentially go deeper into the playoffs. You know, we watched the game all nine innings. We saw the position the Rays were in, comfortable, but still at the finality of it, you're saying I'm still a little shocked that it went this way, because for a team that's been so good at home this year and 50-plus thousand people that were here, everything just to seem like it was going to go Oakland's way.
And he talked about the Rays' special culture.
The one thing about the Rays, it's we talk about culture. I feel like the Rays, they established it without having to, you know, directly talk about it, if that makes sense at all. But you get guys that put on that uniform, they understand that, hey, this is a little bit different. They're going to do things differently despite the ballpark. It's a cool place to play mm-hmm. and to live. There's something unique, and it doesn't always translate in a very tough division in the American League East to the postseason, but, you know, this year it has, and they can breathe a little easier because now they go into a five-game series.
And they will go into that five-game series against the Houston Astros, of course, in the other division series in the American League. You have the Twins and the Yankees. By the way, the Astros expect Carlos Correa to play in the division series opener against Tampa Bay. In the National League, later today, the Dodgers will play host to the Nationals. Dave Roberts talked about why he chose Walker Buehler to start game one rather than Clayton Kershaw.
I think obviously all three of our guys deserve the opportunity to pitch the first game of this, you know, in the division series. We just felt that with Walker getting an opportunity to pitch the first game, also potentially a game five, gives us the best chance to win, you know, and regardless of the opponent.
He talked about how the rotation was decided.
The conversation that we had with all three guys, you know, there was a little bit of home road opponent potentially, but we had already made that decision regardless of the outcome last night. All three of those guys are on board with the decision that we made.
Here's Walker Buehler, who'll start game one for the Dodgers.
Yeah, obviously in the actual playoffs, I had kind of two bad ones and two good ones. And I think for me, the biggest takeaway is if you get into that spot where it's not going so well, I think saving bullpen, eating innings, and things like that is super important, especially when you've got limited rosters and a lot of games to play. So, you know, I think for me, it's just trying to get deep into games and put up zeros is still the biggest thing.
Patrick Corbin will start game one for the Nationals. It's possible Steven Strasburg could start game two for Washington, but they haven't made that decision yet. The Braves and Cardinals will play later today, and Brian Snitker talked about picking Dallas Keuchel to start game one.
Well, I think Keuchel that's why we got this guy. I mean, we went out and signed him because he brought instant credibility. He's been through this war. He's a World Series champion. And I think, you know, when we signed him, we envisioned him making this opening start.
Here's Dallas Keuchel, of course, waited so long to be signed, only reaching an agreement with the Braves in the middle of the season.
I'm not one to come out and just be flamboyant about the whole situation. I mean, when the time comes, I think a lot of us should be as players. But one of the pros about it is that I think if this offseason played out a different way and I were to accept a 4 or 5 year deal, I wouldn't be right here.
And we'll talk about all the series coming up with Keith Law. But before that, we all know hiring can be a slow process. Cafe El Toro COO Dylan Miskiewicz needed to hire director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Buster. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Buster, B-U-S-T-E-R. ZipRecruiter.com/Buster. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
It's more than just a conversation. It's the Weekly Dish with Keith Law and Bias Cat on Baseball Tonight.
And Keith Law scouts for ESPN. He writes for ESPN. But today we're going to absolutely tap into his scientific knowledge. Keith, I need to know if you know the question I asked of Troy. Can you get legally drunk absorbing alcohol through your skin? Because that thing last night, that was the worst dousing I've taken in my lifetime of covering these celebrations in clubhouses. It was unbelievable how soaked I was at the end. Do you think you can?
No, I think that although you can absorb a little alcohol through your skin, it is so volatile. Most of it'll probably evaporate before. Like maybe if you were like bathing in grain alcohol, this would be a different conversation. But I personally have never experienced that.
Right. Well, I'll go see if John Krupa wants to go back into West Virginia and see if we can make that happen. Right. Oh, man. All right. Let's get to what happened last night. Tampa Bay, they did a great job last night taking the crowd out of it. That crowd was crazy. They opened up the gates early. They were excited. And right from the get-go, Keith, it seemed like that the Rays hitters had a great plan in attacking Sean Manaea, who really struggles to pitch inside to right-handed hitters.
Yes. That's always been an issue of his. I'm thinking going back to – so when he was at Indiana State, he wasn't known as a prospect until the summer after his sophomore year, he went to the Cape Cod League and suddenly he's throwing harder. I mean, you see the slider now. It's not all that different today, even after all the injury issues he's had. And so suddenly he emerged as a prospect and was like, well, he's a two pitch guy. And it's a little bit of a different delivery, but of course at 20, 21 years old, you're willing to sort of project on the guy a bit. And since then, he's turned into a good pitcher. He just has not fulfilled the potential promise that he might be a one or two starter. And I think the biggest reason is that, yeah, his changeup does not measure up to his other two pitches. And I think because of the delivery, because of that arm slot, it's hard for him to go glove side to right-handed hitters. And when he does, especially because he does tend to work up a little bit with that four seamer, I think he can get punished in exactly the way you saw last night. I mean, they were hitting some of those, several of those home runs were out to center field. These were really no doubters. And I mean, you want to give a lot of credit to the hitters, but also the ball has to be pitched in certain spots for hitters to be able to drive the ball that far out to center field.
Yeah. And right away, Yandy Diaz takes the crowd out of it. It was interesting. I know the folks who, you know, followed the Rays down the stretch, they didn't think that Diaz had a chance to play in this game. Right. But what we heard from Kevin Cash before the game was that because his swing is so simple, he felt like he could get back into the flow of things more quickly. He'd played only one game since July 22nd, that final game of the regular season in Seattle. And Kevin Cash was exactly right in terms of getting back into the flow of things. What did you see in Yandy Diaz?
Yeah, that was impressive. I think he hadn't had a hit since July. I mean, obviously, he'd only played in the one game. His transformation since the trade is amazing because I've even asked Rays people, and they have said, you know, they didn't feel like they changed anything substantial in his swing. They just let him play. That was the biggest thing. But I mean, he was with Cleveland. He was much more of a ground ball hitter. He was a bit of a ground ball hitter in the minors. He hit for average. Seemed to have a pretty good approach. Cleveland never really had a spot for him to play, but I think it is, I think it's a testament to how strong he is. You're right, the swing is very simple, but what was it? One homer out to the opposite field, one homer out to dead center. I know the ball's juiced. That's also a terrible ballpark for home runs. So both those balls were hit really hard. And I think, again, a testament to just how strong he must be to be able to hit for that kind of power. Good for Tampa Bay for identifying. They did this up and down their roster. It's guys that were just sort of passed over, underutilized, maybe out of favor with previous organizations. Austin Meadows would be another one. They've gotten a ton of value out of those guys this year.
Yeah, 100%. And on the flip side, Charlie Morton just battled his way through rally after rally early in the game when he really didn't seem to have a feel for much of either one of his primary pitches. Just the fact he was able to execute in big spots, you know, and I talked to him during the course of the game, after he came out of the game and asked him, hey, you know, how did you do that? And he said, I don't know, which I loved. I love that as an honest answer from Charlie.
Yep.
What'd you see in him?
Yeah, I was surprised when he came out of the game. He really only struck out four guys, huh? Because I felt like the story of the game last night, if you were just going to show a highlight reel from last night's game, it would be the four home runs and then a bunch of pitchers walking back around the mound after a third strike, right? It just seemed like that was all, especially the last few innings of the game, was just strikeout, 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 walk, strikeout, 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 which obviously we can have that conversation. Morton was the one who didn't do that. And it didn't, again, this is just sort of gut reaction. I would not have said to you, oh, he didn't miss all that many bats. It seemed like he was fine. He was doing his thing. The A's had a good approach against him. I think they did what they were trying to do. They just didn't get sort of the right hit in the right situation. I do think he hit a lot of his spots. He seemed to hit his spots a little better in those critical situations, especially, what was it, first inning when they had the bases loaded. That could have easily gone pear-shaped very quickly for Tampa Bay, because I don't think they were set up for a, you know, seven-inning bullpen game. They would have done it, obviously. But I think the A's, if that had happened, I would have said the odds shifted a little bit in the A's' favor. I thought they were a little better set up for that, whereas the Rays were better set up for, you know, tell Morton, look, if it's five and dive, that's fine. We can get the last 12 outs for you. But I don't think they were necessarily as well set up if they had to go, say, get 21 outs.
Man, and those last four innings were impressive from their bullpen. Look, I'd seen Diego Castillo pitch on television a few times, but I can't tell you that I'd ever seen him pitch in person. That was impressive last night.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, he was really good. And then you have Nick Anderson, and you have Oliver Drake against lefties. You've got the closer Pagan. Yeah. Yep. I mean, that, you know, it's an interesting team to me moving forward against the Houston Astros in the division series. What kind of chances you give the Rays to actually advance past the Astros?
I mean, I would still pick the Astros. I think you would too. If the question is though, do the Rays have a chance? Yes, absolutely. I would say of the four division series, it's baseball, and we know there is no such thing as a playoff matchup where one team doesn't have a chance. That just doesn't exist. I will say of the four division series, if you were asking me confidence in my pick winning, I would say I would have the highest confidence in Houston winning this series. That might be tantamount to saying it's 55-45 in favor of the Astros. You know, you look at the Astros, you look at their top three starters, and you say, I mean, that's a pretty huge advantage, right? That's a huge thing for the Rays to overcome. And I think as much as I respect what the Rays have done with their lineup, and I do think they obviously have some pretty good, if sort of less famous hitters in their lineup, you worry about some of those guys against elite pitchers, right? That is I think maybe the Achilles heel of the Rays clubs over the last several years. That said, Verlander shows up and just kind of doesn't have his best night, especially with the juiced ball this year. You miss a couple of spots early, and next thing you know, the Rays have got four runs on three homers, and suddenly the game is very different. And obviously the Rays do have a shutdown bullpen. That only has to happen kind of once in a series to flip those odds completely on their head. So yeah, I'm picking the Astros. I think the Astros are going to the World Series. But that said, I don't think anyone should feel like this is a lock. And I don't think Rays fans should be, gosh, they're thrilled anyway that they won, but I don't think they should be despairing now that they face the Astros. You were going to have an uphill battle against any of the teams you faced in the division series. And there is absolutely a chance that the Rays can steal a game early and end up taking a series, maybe 3-2 against a superior opponent.
All right, you gave me an idea, and organically we're going to have an element here coming up where I'm going to ask for your confidence in your picks in each of the four division series, but we'll get to that in a second. Nine consecutive losses for the Oakland Athletics in winner-take-all games, which is remarkable. It's the longest streak in Major League Baseball history, but I have a hard time really tying that together. Like, I don't look at that number and say, yeah, it's because of X or it's because of Y. I just think it's a weird factoid. What do you think?
Completely agree. Yeah, I don't think there's anything to it. I mean, God, the one against Kansas City a couple of years ago, they were winning late. And it's just, you know, what happens in the if they lose a game with the last 5-6 outs to go, you're really drawing a larger conclusion from that. Plus, these games that you're talking about are spread over such a long period of time. It's not the same manager. It's not certainly not the same players. It's not even the same kind of roster construction. You look at the different strategies that the A's have used really over the last 20 years to build these clubs, to build sort of these low payroll contenders. They've attacked lots of different things. There was the on-base percentage teams. It was the emphasis, you know, with where they ignored defense. Then a few years later, they kind of switched and said, well, nobody's paying enough attention to defense, and we think we can measure it better, so we're going to go that direction. And now they're kind of the launch angle kings, at least of the American League. I mean, it'd be interesting to see Oakland and the Dodgers in a playoff series, you know, if Oakland had won and gotten to the World Series, because it would have been all launch angle all the time. And so to draw some conclusion from this losing streak, which I just said, ugh, because I feel bad for A's fans to have to go through that. But there's no common thread. There's no through line that connects all of these teams. They've all been pretty well constructed around specific strategies. It's not like one of those strategies is going to dramatically increase or decrease your chances in a single elimination game. So it's unfortunate, but I don't think I could not draw any conclusion from it.
No, I would say this. It's interesting. Let's say that the Athletics get back to the same spot in 2020. Let's say they're a wild card team again. Then I think it becomes kind of a thing among the players. And I'd be very curious to see if Mike Fiers next year finds himself in the same place with the Athletics, having earned consideration for the wild card game start, if Bob Melvin go, you know what? This time we're going to pick him. We didn't pick him in 2018. We went with the opener in Yankee Stadium. That didn't work out well. We went with Sean Manaea, the younger starter. And when we talked to Bob Melvin before the game yesterday, he said that when he told Fiers he wasn't giving him the ball in this game, that Fiers let him off the hook and was really nice about it. But it obviously didn't go well with Manaea. I just kind of wonder if next year, if they happen to be in the same spot, if Mike Fiers would be the guy who gets the ball just because the other two options didn't work out.
Right, to try somebody else.
That's not to criticize Bob Melvin. Right, that's not to criticize Bob Melvin. Just almost like I know if you're the Athletics, you're not going to worry about karma, but maybe it's in the back of your mind a little bit. And I do think if they're in the same spot next year that there will be some additional pressure, much in the way that I felt like, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that losing back-to-back wildcard games really weighed on the Pittsburgh Pirates, you know, losing to Bumgarner and Arrieta in back-to-back years. What do you think?
Yeah, I could buy that they would change their strategy for next year. Not even necessarily karma, but just saying, you know what, it didn't work last year. You know, maybe there's nothing to be drawn from that, but what is the harm as long as it's not like Fiers is a markedly worse option.
No.
The one thing I thought was and I admit I did not read if the A's, you know, maybe talked about what their thinking was behind having Manaea in this game. But, you know, my thought was he's got enough issues against right-handed hitters. Are you really planning on him as a long, you know, deep into the game starter in this situation? Because the Rays can mix it up enough with platoon guys that maybe Manaea is a once through the order guy. I don't know exactly what their plan was in this, but it seemed like it was risky. I'm not second guessing the call. It just seemed risky to me.
All right. As I said, you gave me an idea. We'll go through each of the four division series, and on a scale of 1 to 10, give me your level of confidence in the pick you're making. We'll start with the Athletics and the Astros, since you teed us up on that.
The Rays and the Astros, right? And that I would say.
Oh, I'm sorry. Rays and the Astros. Yeah.
I would say my high picking the Astros. This would be my highest level of confidence. I would say a 7. It'd be hard for me to ever go more than that, especially in a 5-game series. It just takes so little to flip a series like that in the other direction. So, yeah, I'd say a 7.
All right, Yankees and the Twins.
Taking the Yankees, I feel like people who are looking at this as saying, oh, the Yankees always beat the Twins, often destroy the Twins in postseason games, which is true recently. I don't think that matters at all. I would say the Yankees, I'd probably go like 5 or 6 on that one. Let's say 5.
Yeah, exactly. Nationals and Dodgers.
Dodgers, probably a 6 confidence. You know, if the Nationals had come in, the Nationals had won the division and were facing the Dodgers and had not just used, you know, sort of gone a bit all out to win that wild card game, I'd probably give them a little better chance. Dodgers are the best team in the National League. The Nationals could, if at full strength, the Nationals might be the scariest team in the National League to, if you're thinking, who do I not want to face because of that rotation? And the Dodgers still have to face Patrick Corbin in game one, so it's not like the wild card just suddenly gave them a huge out. It just sort of shuffles the Nationals rotation in a way that gives a little more advantage to the Dodgers, who I thought were already a little bit better on paper. So Dodgers, confidence level 6.
Cardinals and Braves.
Yeah, I got a confidence level of about 1 in this one. I have gone back and forth a bunch. I mean, my gut is saying Cardinals. That's not based on a whole lot, certainly not based on anything I would call analysis at this point. This feels like the closest of the two series to me.
Yeah, 100% agree with you. And Jack Flaherty, it feels like it's his big national coming out party.
Yes.
If he winds up having a big series for St. Louis in this one. All right, let's play what you and I love to play. If you were in charge, and we'll look at a couple of franchises today, if you were running the team, what would you do? We'll start with the Toronto Blue Jays, who had a year of development this year. They graduated a lot of their position player prospects into the big leagues, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Kevin Biggio, who's turning out to be a much better player than I think anybody thought. Bo Bichette. Moving forward, if you were in charge of the Blue Jays, what would be your plan for 2020?
Well, I think you're building around Vlad Jr. and Bo Bichette. I'm a complete skeptic on Biggio. Was not really very good until September. And I had a GM just say to me last week, he wasn't speaking about Biggio specifically, but you never want to evaluate off of spring training or off of September. But I do think you have two very clear building blocks there. And I think Vlad Guerrero is going to have a much better year next year, especially if they just move him off third base. I know that doesn't always work, but get him to first base, get him to DH. Rowdy Tellez is not your long-term answer at DH anyway. Let Vlad Jr. play there every day, and maybe that unlocks the hitter we all think he's going to be. So that's two guys right there. You could probably throw Gurriel in there too. It looks like Gurriel might turn out to be a building block as well. You have a little pitching coming. You don't have enough pitching coming. And I think if I were, and there were a lot of comments from Shapiro and Atkins this week where it's sort of like this half-hearted, well, we're going to spend, but we're not going to spend a lot. And I'm sort of setting that aside. If you gave me the keys and said, you can, if you want to spend, you can spend, I would be going after basically all the non-Gerrit Cole options in the free agent market. And I'd probably inquire on Gerrit Cole. You just know, you and I have talked about Cole several times in the last 6 weeks. He's going to get paid. If you're the Blue Jays, you're not going to outbid the Yankees and the Angels and whatever other suitors he has. You could inquire, but recognize you're probably not going to get him and look at every starting pitcher below them. Because, I like Nate Pearson. I think he's going to be part of their rotation next year. I think Anthony Kay is going to be part of their rotation next year. If Patrick Murphy is healthy, maybe he makes 10 starts for them next year. You want to get there a little bit faster? You go get a Zach Wheeler for 3-4 years and recognize, right, next year is sort of a building block year. By 2021, though, now whichever young hitters you want to call part of that core, they've got, you know, a year and a half to 2 full years in the majors at that point. They're probably all more productive. Pearson, Murphy, Kay, these guys have all developed as starters. You got a chance for a pretty good rotation by 2021-22. You'd like to have somebody else in front of those guys. I cannot put together all of the starters I see close in that Blue Jay system and make a playoff caliber rotation, especially in that division, just out of the internal options.
All right. And then there's the New York Mets. You and I strongly disagreed with what the Mets did leading up to the trade deadline, going all in, not cashing in on the value of Zach Wheeler, not cashing in on the trade value of Noah Syndergaard, Edwin Diaz, et cetera, et cetera. But that's all played out. From starting from where we are today with the decisions that the Mets have already made, what would you do, first off, with the manager? I'm surprised that they haven't come out and said one way or the other on Mickey Callaway what they're going to do. You know, to me, I know that they've done a ton of background work in preparing for a possible change there. I feel like just move on. Just, you know, tell Mickey, hey, we're not going to bring you back. Or if you you think you are, just announce it. Because to have him hanging out there now, a few days after the end of the regular season, doesn't make a lot of sense to me. What do you think?
I think it looks ugly, and I think it looks disorganized for a team. And they're not the only team in this situation, right? The Phillies are supposedly still considering, and I don't know if this is accurate, but the local coverage at least seems to be saying that they're still considering whether or not to make a managerial change. Season ended 4 days ago. you should already have made that decision. It seems like the Mets have already made that decision. So just fire the guy and move on. Because the last thing you want to do is be in a situation where your best option, even if you haven't necessarily identified him yet, gets hired by another team. You want to make sure – you don't want to be later than everybody else, whether you're looking for a manager, a scouting director, a GM, anything like that. You want to make sure that you're on the same timetable as everybody else. You get to interview the best candidates. As for the Major League roster, yeah, they're – I don't agree with the strategy. They've traded away, what, three of their top six prospects or so in the last 12 months. I feel like, though, it's – now, unfortunately, it's in for a penny, in for a pound, right? That system has been – devalued enough, stripped of enough talent that they're not building anymore. They were building something pretty good, and now they've traded a lot of that talent. The Major League club is probably 2 to 3 players away from being a 90-win team. Most of this talent comes back. I would try to hold the core together as much as possible, maybe trade some surplus. Like Dom Smith has no place to play, but he's going to be a starter for a lot of clubs. Can you trade him to go get some other piece that you need? The big question that would face me is, are you trading Syndergaard? I feel like if you're trying to contend next year, you just don't. You just keep him because you're a much better club with him. And if you want to get to 90 plus wins next year, which is kind of the price of entry for the playoffs, then you absolutely have to retain all of your core players. And Syndergaard would be one of them. Their odds of getting to 90 wins go down the moment that they trade Syndergaard. And if they do trade him, they would have to trade him for pieces they could turn around and trade somewhere else to just replace what they traded away with Syndergaard.
Well, and I totally agree with your read on it. Where you are today, you ride out the group that you have, and you have to start thinking like Oakland Athletics, Tampa Bay Rays type acquisitions to try to, you know, refortify your bullpen, which is a huge problem, and also the depth on your roster.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the one thing I would say on that bullpen idea, bullpen piece too, I agree with you, but, you know, you went out and got Edwin Diaz, who, look, I didn't like the trade. You didn't like the trade. Neither of us thought Edwin Diaz was going to be this bad this year. And I do hope that Major League Baseball changes the baseball back to something resembling what it was before 2019. And maybe that was the biggest issue with Diaz's slider in particular and with his struggles this year. Maybe he's better next year. I hope he's better next year. But I also hope that the front office looks and says, you know what? Maybe going out and acquiring the biggest name relievers wasn't the ideal strategy. The Phillies tried to do this. They tried to buy and trade for a bullpen last offseason. That also didn't work. That actually blew up in rather spectacular fashion that nobody could have predicted. But still, going out and spending a lot of resources to build a bullpen is pretty high risk. It's a volatile strategy. And if I'm in the Mets front office, if you trade Dom Smith and you get two relief pieces back, okay, that's probably pretty good value. But I would not be targeting this year's Edwin Diaz. I would try to diversify a little bit to make sure I'm more covered so that, recognizing you just can't really predict reliever performance year to year that well, so make sure that you have as many quality options as you can possibly get.
One guy who would intrigue me if I were in the Mets front office and looking at relievers would be Dellin Betances, who, of course, had an injury-plagued year. He wound up hurting his Achilles. You and I can acknowledge here right now, we don't have his medical information. We don't know exactly where he stands. But if the medical information is passable from the Mets' perspective, you know that Betances probably is best served to take a one-year deal. And you know that if he's right, that he potentially is a dominant-type piece. He's been in New York. He's dealt with that whole thing. I would be interested in having that conversation if I'm the Mets with his representatives once he hits the market this fall. What do you think?
Yeah, for sure. I think he's – assuming he'd be able to pitch, I don't know, 5 months out of next year. I don't know what his timetable is. But, yes, I absolutely agree. Like, he's going to be one of the most appealing one-year type options where you go to him – and go to him and say, look, here's a decent base salary, but you can end up with, $12 million plus the more you pitch. Just set a ton of escalators in there so that if he's able to get out there and pitch, he can get paid – at or above the level he might have expected if he'd gone into this offseason healthy. I mean, that's the way that you get a player like that, to say, no, look, if you're able to pitch and healthy, we will pay you as if you'd never been hurt. I think that's – yes, it's the Mets, and we know what their ownership is like, but I still look at them and say, you're the New York Mets, right? You should be able to pay for your best players. And
well, and it's not, and it's not a long-term obligation we're talking about.
Right.
And they should, you know, and it still fits the mode of being efficient, you know, or a polite term for the Mets in terms of being able to address the bullpen issues. And to me, like a base salary, what do you think? Like $6 to $8 million?
Yep.
Like offer him that sort of thing. And then,
yeah,
with,
and say you could double that if you get to, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, you build in a ton of escalators there so that the more he gets on the field, he continues to get paid so that he and his agents in particular can say, no, there's more upside in this deal than anyone else. No one's offering Dellin Betances a year and $15 million off of a year where he's coming off another injury and he essentially didn't pitch. But this is the way you are the Mets. You should be able to throw your weight around, particularly in this environment where it seems like so many teams don't want to pay players. You're in New York. Pay players. You will get the best ones.
There you go. All right, Keith. Well, thanks for doing this.
Yep, my pleasure.
Numbers game.
Sarah Langs, a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, you're at the ballpark last night. What's going to stand out to you from that game last night?
God, the crowd had so much energy, and it went away so quickly. You know, Yandy Diaz with that leadoff home run, and it almost felt over like I never felt like the A's were in the game. And I love that the Rays bullpen got its moment on national TV, and it's going to get even more moments. You know, Charlie Morton was so good, and we can talk about that more, but getting to see, you know, we had our Rays Flicks thing going on the broadcast and people seeing how that all works. I'm so glad that that got its moment in the sun.
Absolutely. All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three.
Number three is nine. So the A's have now lost nine consecutive winner-take-all postseason games, extending what was already the longest such streak in postseason history. They've lost six straight of those at home, which is also a postseason record. Their last winner-take-all game win was Game 7 of the 1973 World Series against the Mets, and that one was at home, so that snaps both streaks, or that's before both streaks started. So in baseball, hockey, and basketball, the only longer losing streaks in winner-take-all games were 11 straight games by the 76ers franchise in the NBA from 1956 through 76, and 10 straight games by the New York Rangers in hockey from 1937 to 1984. So this is really historic territory, unfortunately, for the Oakland A's.
Number two.
Number two is five. So Yandy Diaz became the fifth player in postseason history last night to homer in each of his first two plate appearances of a single postseason. He joined Kendrys Morales in 2015, Evan Longoria in 2008, So Taguchi in 2006, and Gary Gaetti in 1987. And he was just the fourth player to hit a leadoff home run in a winner-take-all game and had the 10th winner-take-all game multi-homer game in postseason history. So what a game from Yandy Diaz, who had basically not played in a very long time.
Number one.
Number one is 25 and 67. So I want to look ahead a little bit because we've got even more postseason baseball, two games coming up today. So at 25 years and 67 days old today, Walker Buehler will be the youngest Dodgers pitcher to start the team's first overall game of any postseason since a 24-year-old Fernando Valenzuela in the 1985 NLCS. So it's a little different than just starting game one of any postseason series. Kershaw was he's the youngest since Kershaw in 2009 to do that, but that was in the NLCS, so he didn't start their first overall game of the postseason. And obviously, I mean, I think we probably could have predicted this for Walker Buehler at the beginning of the season, that this was going to be the year that he came into his own like this and that he would be starting game one of the postseason for the Dodgers, and here he is.
All right, before you go, Sarah, who you got in the National League Series at start today? Dodgers versus Nationals, who you picking?
I gotta pick the Dodgers. You know, I mean, it would be really fun to see the Nationals kind of ride that momentum and keep going, but I think the Dodgers are too good.
All right, Cardinals, Braves.
I picked the Braves to get to the World Series, so I certainly need them to win this series. I think that, you know, again with the Cardinals, you know, it's fun. We saw a late season push. We saw them really kind of get into their own, but I think the Braves are also too good. So we'll see what happens, but I'm really excited for it.
Yeah, you're being stubborn, clinging to your pick the same way that I am, picking the Braves to continue all the way through so you can look smart. All right, Sarah, go catch your flight. Thanks for getting up for us.
Thanks so much, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster, some Bleacher Tweets for you on this Thursday morning. First one comes from Gabe the Babe at work_Gabe. How much pressure is on the Braves to win in four, knowing that if the series goes to five, the Braves will see Flaherty twice. Does Jack Flaherty demand that type of respect?
I'll co-sign that one. Like, I think right now he is the best pitcher. He's the pitcher who's pitching the best right now, and he is on a roll, and he is to be feared. This is a little bit like Mike Scott versus the New York Mets back in the 1986 playoffs, where the Mets had to avoid a Game 7 because they did not want to be dominated by Mike Scott for a third time.
Sure, I'll take your word for it. Next one comes from Hal Stewart at DJ Hal Stewart. If you're Bryce Harper, are you secretly hoping that the Nationals don't win the World Series?
Nah, I don't think so. Yeah, but
oh,
maybe
come on. Yes, for sure. For sure. You never want your ex-girlfriend to be
the bad guy.
You never want your ex-girlfriend to be doing better than you. You hope that you break up and then their life just goes downhill after that.
Wow, Troy comes bursting out of the friend zone to make that observation.
That's what I'm saying. That's just how life works, Buster. Next one comes from Aaron at Aaron San Diego. I enjoyed seeing Buster's B-suit during the Rays celebration last night. Buster, was this the biggest soaking you've received in a celebration, and what was the most memorable celebration that you've seen?
Yes, without a doubt, the biggest soaking I ever got. I was absolutely drenched because it was unlike when Carlos Correa did it back in 2015. It was one bottle of champagne, and then there wasn't anything beyond that. This just kept on coming and coming and coming away from different players, especially Jesus Aguilar. I'm coming for you. memorable celebration? Yeah, I was going to say, just to follow up, was it the most memorable celebration I've seen? I don't think so, in part because the area that they were celebrating in the clubhouse, the visiting clubhouse in Oakland, is so small in an older ballpark, they didn't have a lot of room to maneuver, but they had a lot of fun.
Yeah, it certainly seemed like it was great TV. Justin Simmons at Justin Lance Sim 1. Hey, Buster, in football we hear all the time about coaching trees. Does the MLB have managing trees? And if so, what are some of the more successful ones?
Yes, baseball does. Well, you know, when I read your question first, I was thinking front office trees, and I was going to talk about the Theo Epstein tree. A lot of his folks who work for him have gone on to work for other front offices. Cleveland definitely has that. It's amazing how many people come through the Cleveland organization. And yeah, how about managerial trees? Brad Mills worked under Terry Francona in Boston, and he was a manager in Houston, and Kevin Cash worked with him. And Kevin Cash reminds me so much of Terry Francona in terms of his personality. So those are just the ones off the top of my head. I got to admit, my brain hurts too much to really dig deep to find another one.
I think you're legally drunk from all that champagne, Buster.
Yeah, I know.
Final one this morning comes from Greg Hassa at GV Hassa. Great question. Why does Troy always go first in the uniform and logo quiz with Todd Radom? It gives Buster a slight edge as he can match his pick if unsure. Yeah, Buster,
that's it
why?
For today.
Why?
I want to thank Sarah Langs, to Keith Law, everyone who joined us today. No thanks to Jesus Aguilar, who got me so bad with the champagne last night. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and I'm not going to answer Greg's question.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.